Today's episode of House of Strauss is brought to you by Robinhood. With Robinhood, you can invest in stocks, options, and ETFs right from your phone. You can even spend and earn interest on uninvested cash. And with fractional shares, you can buy stocks in any amount, including companies like Apple, Amazon, and Tesla, for as little as $1. And that's with no commission fees or account minimums. So whether you're new to investing and ready to learn, or just looking for a better experience, stop waiting and join the 10 million Robinhood users. Listeners can get started with a free stock by going to strauss.robinhood.com. That's strauss.robinhood.com. All investments involve risk. This is not investment advice, a recommendation, or solicitation of any security. Other fees may apply. Visit rbnhd.co/fees. The free stock program is subject to certain limitations. Annual percentage yield, APY, on uninvested cash is paid by program banks and is variable. Robinhood Financial is not a bank.
Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
As I've just reached the far side of the lobby, I just hear behind me in the distance, like, economists say, fuck you!
That's what it is. See
Welcome to the House of Strauss. We are joined by Big Waz, of course, Jade Hoy, super producing in the background. Now, I had Waz on because I feel like on this podcast, I haven't talked enough LA basketball scene, specifically the Lakers and the Clippers. And I like getting Waz's perspective because beyond being fantastic in general, he's got this funny perspective in LA, even if he's been there a little while. I think of him as an Alexis Tocqueville. Am I ever going to pronounce that correctly? I'm never going to pronounce it correctly. The Frenchman who gave his perspective on revolutionary America and had his predictions with his Stranger in a Strange Land viewpoint. I view that way. Was with your view of Los Angeles and also the NBA, is that how you view yourself as a stranger in a strange land?
Yeah, you know, oftentimes when you meet people in LA, the first thing out of their mouth is literally, so what do you do? I guess now I can come out and just tell them I'm a cultural anthropologist. That's what I'm doing here in LA. I'm out here soaking up the scene, soaking up the culture, getting a better understanding for the ways and practices of these strange, strange people.
Yeah, you're like the TV show You in the second season, just looking at LA and all of its absurdity. But you love it. I think you love it. Without any irony, that you should have always been here, maybe. I can tell.
I don't even know. I see. So the New Yorker in me would never think that I should have always been here, because I think that living in New York for 30 years is what allows me to enjoy this place. Mm. It's what allows me to understand how much easier it is to live here than it is to live in New York. Like, it's just so much easier to do everything. Like, everything is like the concept that I tell people all the time of, like, you know, getting your groceries at Whole Foods that's near your job in Manhattan, then lugging that thing on the subway so you can get to your house in Brooklyn when it's a snowstorm outside.
Oh, yes.
It's just something that a person in LA, like, you can't fathom the difficulty and the discomfort involved in facilitating that.
I couldn't. I know that sounds very soft, but it's something I just didn't expect as part of my life when I lived in New York, that going and getting groceries would be such a thing, lugging it in the cold and on public transit. And this is maybe what a majority of the country, or at least a significant slice of the country, just does. But it was something that had never occurred to me. And there is something funny about New York, which is in many ways it's one of the most convenient cities, in that the subway is great and it runs 24 hours. I know recently maybe not so great, but, you know, for the sake of argument, fairly all encompassing. But
then there's that aspect where you walk everywhere and then you experience the cold if it's cold. You're not insulated. So in many ways, it's the most convenient, but that also makes it the least convenient.
I mean, it's to me, the idea of comfort is just a far-fetched one in New York City. Like, you're just not going to be very comfortable very often unless, you know, you're like uber rich, right? Where you do have a driver and you do have a bellman and you do have all of these things. Like, you're pretty comfortable, but the rank-and-file New Yorker is going through discomfort all the time. You know, like in the summertime when it's 100 degrees outside and 100 degrees in the subway, and you get on the one subway car that has the one homeless guy who's been sleeping there for 4 hours and hasn't showered for days. And it's like, okay, all of the subway cars are now full because nobody wants to get on that subway and deal with the discomfort of maybe body odor and whatever. And that's not even, you know, to denigrate our homeless population. These are just the realities that you don't face.
Setting aside
LA.
Was, you know, hating the homeless and blaming them for their lot. Just the cold, it's not as cold as, I don't know, say Maine. But when it snows in Maine, it's probably beautiful. It probably looks like one of those Lexus ads where they've got the ribbon on the car, and all those Christmas ads. So it's just ideal backdrop. When the snow hits the ground in New York, it turns into some just gross sludge. It's not pretty. It doesn't really add to life. It doesn't make life look better when you've got inclement weather in New York City for the most part.
Yeah, these positive associations that non-Northeast people have with snow kind of it amuses me but annoys me at the same time. It's like there's nothing fun about it. Like there's nothing fun about shoveling your car out of your driveway at 5:45 in the morning. You know, and this is going to turn into a New York versus LA thing, but like I live with my girlfriend now, Ethan, and she's born and raised out here, right, in Los Angeles, right? Like born and raised in the Valley. And, you know, oftentimes she'll invite family over to the house so we can have a dinner or host a little party, a get together or whatever. And people will call ahead and be like, can you please save me a parking spot near the townhouse? Because they don't want to have to walk for 3-4 minutes to this house because they found the parking spot that isn't directly – like just the idea that you would call somebody to find you a parking spot. Like that doesn't register to somebody like me. But it's like it, – and matter of fact, even it was even worse. There was a lady who was coming in here to sell us curtains. And she called us while she was looking for parking and said, do you guys have a parking in your garage? Because I can't seem to find one really close to you guys. This woman is trying to sell us stuff. And she's telling us her life is too inconvenient. It's just like, you, like, as a New Yorker, you just couldn't even fathom doing something like that.
Man, this is taking me back. I don't have much nostalgia for the year I spent living in New York. In many ways, I'm glad I had it just so I can appreciate, as you are appreciating LA now, what I have out here and the conveniences I have. But I think part of those conveniences have made basketball, and it's never really said, we'll say LA is underrated or maybe generates the most basketball talent. I think it's bigger than that. I think in many ways, the NBA, the natural home of it is in the American West.
Of course.
It's where people can play basketball year round. That was something that bothered me in my early 20s when I was living in New York. It was obvious, but nobody pulled me aside and said, hey, 7 months out of the year, you're not going to be able to just play basketball outside. It's going to be impossible. It's just not going to happen. You're going to have to find some sort of gym situation to do it. But you can play basketball year-round out here, and you look at LA, produces the most talent by far of any area in the world, by the way, not just the United States. I've long said you take the general LA area and put it up against any country's basketball team and the LA area will win. So you have that, and the Warriors, they were a sleeping giant for such a long time, but they became big in the Bay Area. Currently on the gap year, I mean, there are a lot of competing sports in the Bay, obviously the Niners, Super Bowl, but big there. Portland, that team's huge there. You know, the Suns were big, but they've just been so bad for so long. But I think in general, basketball, pro basketball, it's the sport of the American West, unacknowledged.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. And, you know, I think about myself like when I was younger and I was like super into basketball and constantly like you couldn't find me without a basketball in my hand. And when it was wintertime, I remember my older brother who was 11 years older than me. So he's a lot older than me. He'd be like, man, Magic Johnson was shoveling his driveway to play ball in the wintertime. Like, it was this idea like that you shouldn't let inclement weather stop you from hitting the park and getting shots up, right? It was this, which obviously now with hindsight, I recognize is insanity. But that was sort of the mentality and the ethos growing up on the East Coast, particularly as a guy who just was obsessed with basketball. And, you know, the West Coast, it only makes sense that that would be the case. And I think, you know, LA in particular with the NBA, why it's the capital of the NBA is because NBA players more so than every other sports are celebrities. They are stars. And this is a place that services stars. This is a place that services celebrity. Obviously, if you have a certain amount of wealth, which these guys do have, you will be fine no matter where you are. But there's just a way in which LA services wealth, stars, star status and fame and things of that nature.
And the entire apparatus is there. And CAA,
yes,
huge,
yes,
in the NBA, but CAA is huge in general in entertainment. It's rooted in LA, and you've got that crossover, and you've got all the agents of NBA players there. I've analogized it to it almost feels as if league office Fifth Avenue's relationship with LA and the industry apparatus running the NBA, it's almost like, if we want to go back to those Alexis Tocqueville, I can't do it. You know, look it up, people. But if you want to do that analogy, it's almost like the NBA Fifth Avenue is Britain and LA is the United States. It's almost like they're trying to impose control from very far away, and they don't have that much control, as the people really running the league are in Los Angeles and are, I mean, not apathetic to whatever dictates come from Fifth Avenue, but they're almost doing their own thing. It feels more so like that recently, too.
Well, and the thing that cats got to understand, right, if you're Magic Johnson and these people are talking to you about tampering, when the bottom line is, in July and June, when you're at the Soho House in Malibu, which for our listeners, it's basically this uber exclusive social club, right? They have locations in New York, Chicago, all over the place. But the Malibu one, because it's on the beach, Soho Beach House, is the most exclusive one of them all, right? For example, like if you get a Soho House membership in New York, you get to go to all of the Soho Houses everywhere, except for the one in Malibu. Like, you have to do your own application process and all of that at the Malibu one. So it's like, if I'm Magic Johnson or I'm Doc Rivers, who, by the way, I've seen at the Soho House in Malibu, right? And I run into Paul George there, motherfucker, I'm not tampering. I'm doing what the people in elite NBA society do over the summer, because they're all here and we all do the same things over and over again. So the concept that I'm tampering by leaving my house, period, is just ridiculous as a notion. And I'm sorry, you can't understand that, owners in Milwaukee. You will not understand that in Chicago. You will not understand that in New York, right? You have to be here to understand how the infrastructure sort of functions.
Yeah. I guess the two asides is, I think Malibu is the most exclusive real estate in the United States, or at least one of the most exclusive parcels on the planet, in part because they have so much red tape with the California Coastal Commission that it's effectively impossible to build anything new there.
Yep.
So,
and the locals are holding on to that thing quite tightly. They exert a decent amount of power over there.
I remember Suzanne Summers' house in Malibu burned down, and somebody was asking her, well, are you going to build it again? And I think the response was, no, I'm just going to sell, because at this age, I can't go through all that. I can't go through all those zoning fights and dragged out process. Just sell the parcel of land. It's not even worth it. But that creates the conditions where it's so exclusive. One of the reasons why, by the way, I was a little surprised to see KD recently sell his place in Malibu is that Malibu real estate, it only goes up. It does not it does not go down. So that's one aside. And then I think the second aside is the idea of tampering. When the Warriors hired Bob Myers, the idea wasn't just, hey, this is an impressive guy and, oh, he really knows the cap. That's pretty cool. No, it's this guy is a former agent and, whoo boy, maybe he can really tamper for us right now. I'm not saying they said that, right? Because tampering is a little bit eye of the beholder, but the idea is that this guy can recruit. That's a lot of the game. And so it's hard to know where recruiting ends and tampering begins, and it's probably a fairly arbitrary line, and especially, as you're saying, in Los Angeles, where everybody's there together.
Yeah, and it's hard to overstate this because here's the thing about a place like, say, New York City, right, where there's a lot of wealth. But there's also a lot of industries. And so, like, the way the wealthy people function out in New York is just totally separate. Like, they eat at restaurants that you've never heard of. And so, therefore, not only could you not get a table there, it would never occur to you to even try. You will never run into Jamie Dimon, you know, the CEO of JP Morgan Chase, at a restaurant in New York. It just would never, ever happen to us, the little peons, the little worker bees of New York City. Whereas, like, in L.A., like, you're going to see LeBron at catch. Like, you're going to see KG in Malibu. Like, you're going to see – and you know, because, I don't want to sound like I'm some type of social butterfly, but I go out enough to where I see these dudes, right? Like a spot, and I told Brian Curtis this for his article that he did a few months back about this very same subject. I was like, look, like I'm at Delilah, which is like, you know, you kind of have to know people to get in, but I know somebody well enough to where it's like, all right, you're fine. You can come to this place every now and again and pay $20 for a cocktail, no problem. And I'm casually just standing there next to my friend, and LeBron James walks right by me, and he's with Anthony Davis, and their table is 10 feet from us. And that's what happens here all the time. There's only but so much that these people do. It's not like New York, where these people might as well live on another planet. Like, I promise you, Jay-Z and Beyonce is not going to eat at the same restaurant as you in New York. It just will never happen. But in LA, they're all together and they're all doing the same things all the time. That's just how the culture functions out here. And you know, I don't know. I guess there's like a protective bubble around celebrity and what they can do, but like they just have trust that, you know, something like Delilah is curated enough that I have no issues going there whenever I want to, right? And that goes for LeBron to even Mo Harkless, who I've seen in there a couple of times. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's just how the culture functions out here.
Yeah, and I think the LA culture is one that it almost wants an amount of serendipity to occur. It's very industry, and I ran into this guy and he can produce this movie for me. Yep. And I ran into that guy at that thing. And maybe it's a place that is interested in the entertainment industry and the networking it takes to do that. And that is just a little less organized than, say, the financial industry that runs New York. It's just a different situation where I don't know if those moments of serendipity necessarily are part of that. Are part of that thing.
They don't, because you know why, Ethan? Everything doesn't feed back into whatever Goldman and JP Morgan Chase are doing, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in LA, literally everything sort of feeds back into and revolves around entertainment some way, somehow. So therefore, like LeBron James, he's literally making movies, producing movies, acting in movies. I'm sure Mo Harkless has some fledgling entertainment entity, whether it be a record label or, you know, some content production farm or whatever. Everybody somehow, some way figures back into the one, like LA is a one industry town, right? It's no different than some steel mill town in the Midwest. You know, decades ago, and how that would have operated, like where everything feeds back into that one factory that's feeding everybody in the town, right? LA is like that with entertainment. Everything circles around back to entertainment, music, acting, whatever. That's just how it, how the town functions.
Yeah, and the way that this town functions up where I am, it's a little more simple, I think. And the athletes are interested in it, but it's just more direct. It's funny that the Gold Rush started this whole thing, and it's still a Gold Rush mentality where these guys who play for the Warriors, they want to get in. You know, why do venture capitalists get rich? It's because they get in on a company that's going to go big time before it's even public. The public doesn't have the chance to get rich like this. But if you've got a certain amount of money and if you're in this industry, I think the rule as it was broken down to me by a prominent venture capitalist guy was, can you recognize what's going to be big and can you get in? That those are the two big things, because not everybody can get in on that ground floor. And so dudes on the Warriors, maybe not these Warriors. These Warriors might be more likely to earn regular person salary. But the old Warriors, the Dynasty Warriors, it was a game to them of can they kind of play venture capitalists, get to know these people, and get a piece of these companies before the public can even get in on it. That's just, I think, a more focused sort of game than the LA thing, I believe.
Oh, absolutely. And this really, there's nothing so, LA is just the kinds of characters who you meet, right? Like, I don't think you would ever meet somebody in the Bay Area who told you their profession was quote unquote dot connector. That just wouldn't happen, right? And it never happened when I was out in New York. It's just, this place lends itself to that. There's like all of these people sort of floating in and around the industry, and it's an in or out mentality. Like, it's either you're in the game and you're functioning and you're thriving, or you're striving to be. And everybody on a certain level understands that they're either in or they're out. And that's why, and it colors so many of your interactions here, where, again, like in New York, you don't talk to strangers. Like, you're not going to be at a bar and just strike up a conversation with some random dude. Like, it happens, but very infrequently. Whereas in LA, people go out of their way to introduce themselves to you. And I think, I can't be sure because I haven't gone out and conducted some experiment, but I think a lot of it has to do with anybody who I'm talking to is potentially important. Could potentially have some important job in the industry, could potentially be some assistant to a Harvey Weinstein or a LeBron James or whatever. And I need to act accordingly. Like, I need to treat everybody who I meet as potentially important. And I think that's happening, you know, all the time. And that's just the nature of this town, I guess, man.
Well, it's funny. I didn't even have designs on talking about the cultural anthropology aspect. I wanted to talk a little bit of the old actual basketball. I'm going the other way.
Oh yes, let's do that.
I've drummed up this. I haven't drummed it up, but I've been early on. Whoo, the NBA's interest is actually declining, and nobody's admitting it. Yeah, I've been banging that drum, and now it seems when I go on Twitter, at least, it's such a hot topic. And now I'm almost going the other way, and I'm looking at this NBA season and going, you know, this little, you know, the dog days of this NBA season. Kind of liking it a little bit. There's some juice here. It's mostly in the small markets, but you got your Grizzlies, Ja Morant situation, and you've got the Nuggets with Porter Jr. I mean, man, that's a pretty cool situation. I'm into that. I'm watching that on League Pass. And I don't totally know what to make of the two teams in LA. I don't. It's funny. I think the Lakers have given us a great season. I know there's been some scuffling of late, and you see their fans are now getting anxious, and I'm looking at it where you just, at this point in the season, you don't want to overrate any particular result. I mean, I think you almost show who you are in the beginning of an NBA season, and then whatever happens from there on out, you don't want to get too high or too low. Maybe they got an issue or two. I don't know. But in general, the Lakers, I think, have given us a surprisingly engaging season. And LeBron, even if in the past in Cleveland, he was pacing himself, He's given the people an entertaining product. It's been a delight, and I don't know if the public has resonated to it because there's no story along with it that they can really buy into. This seems to have all been done for LeBron's media ambitions, and I don't think the public is that interested in it. But for the people in LA and for Laker fans, I think this has been fantastic. The organization was on its ass. And what a turnaround. And so I think they're really enjoying it. That's my perspective from just talking to Laker fans. But did the Clippers – do you think the Clippers have missed an opportunity? Because it seems as though they've just kind of been checked out and they've been pacing themselves. And I don't know if they're the kind of organization that can afford to do that. Maybe it ends in them winning a championship and that's all that matters, some would say. But I don't know, man. If you don't show up for the season or make an impression on people, I am starting to believe that it's about I don't know what I'm saying. I guess what I'm saying is it feels almost like a mistake or like something that's at least unfortunate for them to have not asserted themselves as this great super team. Yeah,
I understand what you're saying.
Thank you.
I think what you're saying is they're not coming out like the 14-15 Warriors in capturing the imagination of the basketball viewing public.
They're in second place and they've barely had their two guys together.
Completely fine. They're doing completely fine. But that thing that you're describing,
I think they're the favorites. I think they're the favorites.
Oh, everybody would agree with you. Nobody would disagree with that. But I want to get back to the Lakers. I think a couple of things are at play there. I think last season almost essentially might as well have never happened. Right? Like the team was mediocre, specifically after LeBron came back from the injury, and none of those players are even here anymore. The team didn't go to the playoffs. Like that season, it was basically the definition of a lost season. And I think Laker fans, what happened was, you know, you sort of get LeBron James and you're used to rooting against this guy. You're used to having this Kobe better than LeBron argument. So it's kind of this natural tension that occurs where it's like, and you could feel it at Laker games last year where it's like, is this guy finished? Is he a fraud? Was this a waste of our time? Like you could get the sense that it's like, this isn't Kobe.
The low point was the celebration of whatever benchmark LeBron achieved in that Plachke column. I think was the low point, if you remember.
And Plachke was beating that drum like, oh, we're the Lakers. You're supposed to come in here. We expect championship level, blah, 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 which was fair. But at the same time, LeBron James and his team were clearly planning something much bigger than whatever the hell it was that they could achieve last year with that group, right? I think that plays a part in it. And another thing was this summer, and I remember it quite vividly because I was confused by it, people largely panned the Anthony Davis trade. They just did. They said Pelinka got fleeced. They gave up way too much. The pick swaps, and this, this, and that. Oh, they're putting all these pieces together on the fly. It's not going to work. People were down on this team to come into the season. They were extremely down. And, you know, I think that permeated within the fan base, this, like, unsureness of, like, well, LeBron was supposed to save us last year, and it didn't do anything. Now we got AD here.
It was considered smart and refined to pan that trade. And look, we'll see years later. We'll see years later how it might work out. But yeah, I think it was interesting how the basketball intelligentsia were not positive going into the season about a team that, you know, could be the favorite or at least the co-favorite.
Here's the thing about that, Ethan, why that calculation never made sense to me. LeBron James signing with this team never had anything to do with the savvy front office moves. Neither did AD wanting to force his way over there. That's not how this team operates. They operate at a different advantage. So, yeah, you can do your stuff, your smart stuff at the margins, OKC. Like, go ahead. Like, you have to do that. The Lakers don't have to. They have a built-in people want to be here so much so that they will sacrifice their reputation. They will sacrifice all of these things to make sure, to ensure that they put the purple and gold on. That's why I thought those calculations were kind of foolhardy. Like, you can't make the same calculations that you would for the Orlando Magic that you do the Los Angeles Lakers. They don't operate in the same NBA realities. That's why I thought it was kind of, I don't want to say disingenuous. It's just sometimes I think people in our industry want to seem smarter than they actually are when it's just like, No, it's LeBron and freaking AD, right? And the bottom line is, even with LeBron, if you want to say he slipped, like, do y'all not remember the 18 finals where he put up 50 in game one against probably the best NBA team we ever saw? And that's what he did with Rodney Hood as his second best player. Like, do y'all not remember this? You understand? Like, he's still really good. AD's still really good.
I guess there was some natural skepticism of how long it would go. You know, how much longer can LeBron have that influence on the season? And, I mean, this season's just been impressive. I don't know what leadership happens exactly behind the scenes, but for everybody to effectively have their proper role, it's almost underrated. I have to say what.
So I did a Q&A with Danny Green before the season started, right? And you know, it's a player. It's before the season, and he's feeding me all this optimism about the chemistry and blah, 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 blah. And like, there's so many guys with veteran experience, diversity of experience, and everybody sort of has something to contribute as far as their NBA journey and where they've been. When you do consider a guy like LeBron, Danny Green, DeMarcus Cousins, Rajon Rondo, like, these guys have a diverse experience base. And I think most importantly, like, I think more important than Rajon Rondo being not very good whatsoever at basketball anymore is that LeBron respects him. Mm-hmm. Whatever that's like, that's worth something. Like, this, like, he respects him in a way that he didn't respect Deion Waiters and Isaiah Thomas III and or even a Kyrie Irving. I think there's just a level of respect that he has for Rondo and a level of respect that the other guys do for guys like Boogie Cousins and stuff like that, that matters in that locker room, right? I think that's what you're seeing happening. It's like, these guys are kind of older and there's a respect for whatever Rondo achieved with that Boston Big Three era stuff, right? Like, there's just respect going on, mutual respect in that locker room. And I think that's why they've been able to come together the way that they did.
Yeah. They are, I wonder if they start resonating overall in a way the NBA needs them to continue to be good. And maybe
I don't think
compete.
That'll happen till the playoffs.
Yeah. You think that's when people will say, oh, look at the Lakers. Oh, this is pretty cool.
And I think that's what the Clippers are making as a calculation, because if you are around the Clippers at all, and I'm around them a lot, like, that's a bunch that's not lacking in confidence.
No.
Like, they feel like they're going to win the championship. They know it. They know they're going to win the championship.
I think they are too, if I had to guess.
100%. And that started at Media Day, the first day. Like, they put Kawhi and Paul George up there together, and Kawhi looked calm, at ease, like, we're good. And so that's why I think they've taken this direction in the regular season. They think they're going to stomp the Lakers in the playoffs.
I mean, the team with the best wings tends to win out at this point. Maybe that's too reductive a way to look at it, but they would certainly be my choice. I wish in a way that they were, I don't know, something that we could enjoy as a culture more. I like the idea of them as a team. I'm excited to watch them when they play the Mavericks. I'll definitely check that out if it's Luka versus Kawhi. But yeah, there's just something about them where they've almost been in the background while also being the predominant favorite. It's a strange situation, and it's one in part that we have because the Lakers are just so much more popular than the Clippers at home that is almost impossible to exaggerate. You know, you because you live there. You can't even exaggerate.
You can't.
It's not even Mets Yankees. It's like the Port St. Lucie Mets versus the Yankees.
Yeah, 100%. There's no man, like, the only comparison that might track is the Nets and the Knicks. There's a lot of parallels between the relationships that those populations have and those fan bases have with those teams in these cities. If you just go to a Clipper game and then go to a Laker game, like, it just feels different. You know, there's just a different energy level in the building. Like, this, the Clippers are like, I remember I lived in a place called Altoona, Pennsylvania, back when I was in college. Back in the days, and I used to love going to Altoona Curve games. It was minor league baseball, like, to the point where, Ethan, like, they had a parking structure, right, that you can drive to the top of and just watch games for free, right? Like, just bring beers and watch games. Or you can pay the $8 ticket to go watch the Curve. But I don't want to say the Clippers are minor league. They're major league. Their front office is professional as hell. Their owner is by multiples and multitudes the richest owner in the league, right? Yeah. They are a major league organization. They're building their own stadium in Inglewood with their own money and kicking James Dolan's ass in the courts to do so, by the way. I'm just saying the atmosphere at their game is that of a minor league baseball team. It's family. It's fun. It's like there's kids there, and it's just like this nice thing. It's nice. The Lakers is not. There's actually, you know, I don't want to say it's a seedy underbelly to what's happening with the Lakers, but there's a lot more Instagram models at the Lakers games. You know,
like, just, the Lakers have always been grimy like that. Yep, they've always been, hey, do you know Jack Nicholson goes to the bathroom at halftime and, you know, and his mood is a little different when he comes back. That's always been the Lakers.
Yeah,
I don't think I'm telling tales out of school. I feel like this is fairly well known.
You're not. You're 100% not. And that's just the attitude. And another thing, Ethan, that catches me off guard a lot of times being out in the world here is the actual passion for the team.
Yeah.
They love the Dodgers out here a lot. They love, you know, they don't really care about the Rams and the Chargers.
The Chargers, oh my God.
USC gets a lot of love out here too, right? But the Lakers are the thing. And I remember Bomani making the point, and this is before I lived here. He was like, that's the thing that unites that city.
Yeah.
Like, everybody is a Laker fan. The brown people on the east side in Boyle Heights, the black people in South Central and Compton and Long Beach, the people in the valley, all of the rich people in the hills and in Beverly and all of that. Like, they're all Laker fans.
Yeah.
That's the one through line of the entire city is the Lakers. And being out when, like, you know, inevitably people find out what I do and the first thing I hear is, fuck the Clippers. I'm just like, oh, what the hell? You know, like, it's like the passion for this team, it catches you off guard.
Yeah, I remember being hit with it when I went to a game, I think it was 2005, and I was mostly going to Warriors games back then. And I just remember, was it 2005? I was at Staples, and they've still have an intro that's similar where the curtain descends from the top of the rafters and there's a crescendo. Yep. And you see the Lakers of yore playing on the curtain and you go, whoa, this is a decades deep tradition. Yep. Of success in this city. And coming from the perspective of watching Warriors games, especially at that point, there's nothing like that. There's nothing even close to anything like that at the old Oracle Arena. But it's, hey, in a way I like it. And I like that a tradition can't be so easily displaced. It makes me feel as though the accomplishments right now have some meaning that you can't just kick them. You can't just kick them aside.
I think they do. And the reason why I say that is, so, you know, of course, New York, the Knicks fan base, it's crazy. It makes no sense whatsoever, the loyalty that franchise engenders in that city. So what I tell people about the Lakers and their fans is, like, imagine Knicks fans, but if the Knicks actually gave them something to love. Like, if the Knicks actually reciprocated and rewarded that loyalty and, you know, and that engagement, imagine Knicks fans, what they would be like if they actually had reasons to be fans. So it's that passion and that level of engagement mixed with actual accomplishments, well, recent ones too.
And what happens is you wouldn't think that a city could share a team in that way when you consider just how vast Los Angeles is and how many people are coming from different parts of the world in this spread out city. But here's what happens. I think of my friend John, whose parents are from Egypt. Well, it's not like John's father arrived in LA one day and heard of the Lakers. No, he knew what the Lakers were before he got here, right? Yeah. He was aware of them and into them before he came to the city of Los Angeles. I think that's a little bit of an insight into how their brand withholds or withstands being in a very dynamic city with so many different kinds of people is the global appeal of the NBA. And specifically with the NBA, there are only a few teams and a few players who get out there, and the Lakers are one of those teams.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, just again, in LA, so much of it is about celebrity and fame and stardom. And the association is just, when you think of that, you think of the Lakers. You just do. You do not think of the Clippers. And guess what? For the past, basically after that Kobe championship, the Clippers have been, the 2010 finals, yeah. The Clippers have been a much better organization, better ran. They've won more games. They've had more playoff appearances, more playoff wins. All of that stuff, it doesn't matter. It does not matter. Like, nobody cares. And I promise you it doesn't matter, because even when it was before, the year before LeBron got there, where it was just Lonzo and B.I. and the young kids and all of that, those games still had more juice than Clipper games. They just did. And it was awful basketball being played. It was laughable. But those games still had juice. Like, they just have staying power here in a way that I think, I don't want to say it's intractable, but I think, again, the Clippers have to literally kick their asses in the playoffs and win the championship and look good doing it. And I think they'll get some respect. But I think, you know, there has to be some drama, you know. And I think, you know, Ethan, when you brought up the stuff about the interest in the NBA waning right now, right? I think we're in a transitional period, and yeah. I see a lot of stuff out there about there needing to be more game analysis, which I agree with. But the fact that there hasn't been a soap opera element to the Lakers this year contributes to that lack of interest. Is what I think honestly.
I think that there are some elements. I like how you're saying a transitional period, because look, I think the NBA should do some actual structural reforms, but I also think that we are seeing another generation forming, right? In 2007, if we go back to that, that was one of the lowest rated finals ever. Well, who was in that finals? The San Antonio Spurs and a young LeBron James. America had not been properly introduced to him.
Not at
His
all.
His team wasn't that good, but that was just the beginning of the introduction that would pay off later on. And so I think that might be happening currently, where we're seeing some really intriguing young talent in the league, and we'll just see how popular they get. I don't know how popular, say, Luka might get. I have the feeling that if he was Luke Donald from Iowa,
I've been making that point that all season.
That he would already. Oh, because so that's.
Let me tell you something, Ethan.
Well, we can't Luka do anything Doncic about it. Like, we can't change his identity.
If that man was born in Indiana, this ratings, this hype hoopla thing that we're all complaining about, as people who work in and around the industry, would not exist. We would not be able to stop. We'd be sick of him already. Seriously, like, just think about the Jimmer hype machine, bro. Yeah. And he was doing that at BYU.
Well, I think this is I don't even know if I should talk about this extemporaneously, because it seems like there's some landmines here, but fuck it, I'll do it. An untold aspect when people come up with their various theories for decreased interest in the NBA within the United States. And I remember thinking about it when I was at Allie's grandmother's house, and there's a poster of the Dream Team there, because she's actually a big basketball fan. So there's this Dream Team poster, and I'm looking up there, and I'm seeing Chris Mullin, and I'm seeing Larry Bird, and I'm seeing Christian Laettner and John Stockton. Yes. And I was thinking to myself, you know, the sport is about as white as it was back then, but the majority of those guys have been replaced by Eastern European dudes. And that is the untold story. And there's nobody at fault. I mean, these guys in Eastern Europe have earned it. They're really that
they
great.
Have.
They're better they're better than the white American players.
But who was the roof of guys from the former Soviet bloc?
Well, if you're from those countries and you speak those languages, it would be rather appealing. But there's a language barrier there, and people do like to root for the people from their own country for the most part. So it's funny to me. I remember thinking when Adam Silver was saying, "Oh, I just wish that there was a Chinese superstar." Yes. He said that at the finals. I was thinking of just the shit show that would have ensued if he had said, "And a white American woman would also probably be a benefit to us."
Listen, here's the thing, Ethan, and all of those things are true and right, and because, and I know this because of, I was living in New York when Linsanity happened, and the cool thing about it, and people who don't know that very many Eastern Asian people or even Southeast Asian people don't understand the sort of cultural divides that exist among, say, Japanese people and Filipino people, right?
Yeah.
But the Linsanity thing was so amazing, particularly in New York City. And I'm sure that it went up in places like San Francisco and Los Angeles, too. I wasn't here and I can't document that.
I remember walking at that time when he was playing the Knicks. I was walking through Oakland Chinatown. I remember looking into a barbershop and just looking at everybody watching the game on the TV and going, "Oh my God, this is a thing."
And the thing about the Linsanity thing that I found most cool and amazing is that the entire Eastern Asian and Southeast Asian diaspora got behind it. It didn't matter that he was Taiwanese. Korean people were rooting for it. Chinese people were rooting for it. Japanese people were rooting for it. Filipino people were rooting for it. Like, it was a thing. It was crazy. And I think, you know, that's what we're missing right now. I wish Luka Doncic was from Indiana every single day, dude. Like,
nothing can be done about this. He cannot just have his identity magically warped.
I know. This thing would be going so crazy. But, you know, but I think Zion Williamson is an extremely compelling personality. I mentioned this on DA's podcast, The Hoops Adjacent, but I watched his podcast with JJ Redick, and the kid just, I don't know, he's special. He beams positivity. He, like, can express a level of, you know, personal humility and, like, understanding the moment that he's in, understanding what it means to be Zion Williamson, and he gets it. And I think he's super easy to root for, and his game is going to trend. I think he's special. The Ja Morant thing taking off. I'm so happy he's doing the crazy shit that's, you know, that's bite-sized and Instagrammable and TikTokable and all of that stuff. I love what he's doing with that. I just think there's enough young guys that are going to be able to carry the day when we're tired of talking about KD and LeBron.
Yeah, I would hope so. And I hope the Porter Jr. situation in Denver gets to where it could get to, because that's very intriguing. Now, yeah, maybe we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, and maybe he has some defensive concerns, right? But there is a chance if he really pops, if he really becomes a star, then that's like Mountain West 2011 Thunder kind of situation. That just would get the Nuggets to a level I've never seen the Nuggets at. And so I'm excited about that potentially.
Yeah, I love the Nuggets situation. I started out as a Jokic skeptic, like a huge one. I've made a 180. I think he's special. I think he's incredible.
If he was Nick Johnson from from Maine,
forget about it. That passing,
he's chubby.
Let me tell you something. He's chubby. He has a post up game. Like, actually backs people down, puts them under the rim. The passing, the shooting, the fundamentals, Ethan. That's always the buzzword. Fundamentals that this
Nick
kid
Jost
possesses.
Nick Jost? Would it be Nick Jost?
It'd be a wrap. Dirk Nowitzki could never even catch traction out here. Like, it's crazy. Like, the idea that Nike never put out a Dirk Nowitzki
would
shoe.
Would it be too taboo for Adam Silver to say, "Look, we need, you know, we had Linsanity, we need people from everywhere. We also need to do some sort of ambassadorial work, and have some workshops and some basketball camps out in the out in Trump country, out in the Midwest.
Listen,
you know, we need some.
I don't.
We need our JJ Watt. Like, what if Adam Silver
100%.
Said that?"
We do. It's true.
I don't even know where JJ Watt's from.
I don't think that the actual players would be offended by the idea because they get it. They're a lot savvier about what it takes to increase the bottom line these days. You know, and we need to do more reach out in the heartland. Let's face it, bro. Like, the idea that they just couldn't be an incredibly great NBA player, you know, from Nebraska, I just don't buy it.
Just trying to think, could JJ Watt have been a basketball player? Or is he just too bulky? This is just probably too bulky. I don't think it's going
to happen. JJ White might not have been able to be a basketball player, but shoot, man, I don't see why old boy on the Angels couldn't have been a basketball player.
HGH guy? Oh, sorry. I was just going to say it coded, but you actually said the name.
Mike Trout, why couldn't he have been I'm pretty sure he was a all-city basketball player himself. But, you know, for whatever reason, we push white boys away from the sport these days.
Yeah, I don't know if we push them. I mean, they're just different cultural tendencies. Different people want to do different things. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows
why they... I think a lot of it honestly has to do with white people themselves.
I just think it's funny that the NBA had these designs when it went international. Dollar signs in its eyes. And they're like, oh, man, we're going to get another Yao Ming. We're going to get superstar from China. Oh, wow. You know, we might get a superstar from one of these other big countries. And look, you know, Dirk, he's from Germany. You know, what if we get some other guys from some big countries like that? And the guys they get, it's, you know, it's Luka from Slovenia, which has, you know, as much people as a small market NBA city as a country. And those are the guys that it's getting.
And we know it's problematic, but like the only reason boxing still maintains as like a pretty big moneymaker is they're trading on this culture war stuff.
It's like the version of the Purge, but in sport form. So it doesn't actually hurt us.
He's from Mexico. He's from England. He's bringing all his, you know, his cultural upbringing and all of his customs with him into the ring. And so is that guy. And they're going to fight essentially to the death. like it's no different than essentially what we were marketing with Magic and Larry Bird. Like the ball, like come on, like we know why Larry Bird is a god in Boston, right? It's because he's a white guy excelling at something that white people typically don't excel at in Boston. Like that sells itself. I mean, that's so obvious to me. We need that. We need it back. White people, do better. Come on, we need you.
Well, yeah, this podcast is dedicated to, if you're the white Americans out there, you're really falling down on the job as far as basketball is concerned. You really need to get all the Billy Hoyles out there. You got to really get your game up. I mean, that's what we're saying. That's the ultimate message of this podcast.
100%.
Here's the thing. Why do I feel like people are going to object to things that we're saying, even though
I don't think so. Nobody can object.
Nobody can object. We didn't make the world.
What are you
going
to object to?
As Henry Abbott said of David Stern, he lived in reality. We're just living in reality here. That's what we're doing.
Like, you think I rooted for Tiger Woods because I just suddenly liked golf? It's like, I never seen a black man do that before. It was life affirming. What are you talking about?
Oh, man. Should we talk Aaron Hernandez documentary at all?
Please, whatever you got. I could talk about that all day.
Because I heard that you were talking about another podcast. I don't want you to step on yourself.
It was six of us, so it's not like I got all of my takes off. Like,
okay. Yeah. Well, look, you know, I apologize to anybody out there who just wants pure basketball talk. You know, this is what we're tacking on at the end of it all. And actually, we've gotten some positive feedback when we talk about cultural products. When we talked about the favorite movie scenes of the last 20 years, that was something some people liked. I was drawn to it just because of how much Jade loved it. And I was laughing to myself watching it because I could tell it wasn't just the quality of the documentary. There was something so Northeast and Connecticut that it just scratched all the Jade itches in addition to the actual fascinating material in there. I saw some people criticizing it too. And I get it. It's not perfect. And maybe they went a little far flung in certain directions. That happens. I get it. But the thing itself, here's what I was trying to figure out was, I found myself fascinated by the story of Aaron Hernandez. But what's the moral of the story? I don't know what lessons I took from any of it.
I mean, the lesson to me is all of these things work in concert with each other. Like, you can't disentangle the guy being a closeted homosexual from the guy growing up with an abusive dad. The guy losing that same abusive dad, who was basically his moral compass in life, suddenly at a young age. Like, you can't disentangle CTE. To me, like, the message of the doc is that all of these things are working in concert with one another.
Yeah.
And all of those things going unaddressed and untreated is what you can get when that happens.
Maybe some of the complexity was what was interesting. That
to me, that's the whole doc,
that his dad was abusive and really broke him in a way, but he needed him.
Yes. Yep.
He was a Jenga piece that if you took it out of the puzzle, everything else fell apart. I mean, that is the messiness of life right there.
Yes, exactly.
That this guy severely just did things to him that I think made him unable to prosper as an individual without the father. But that still means that the father's exit was completely fatally damaging to his life. And then, I mean, it was just – I felt almost voyeuristic to listen to the prison phone calls. I it's hard to feel a lot of sympathy and think, oh, I shouldn't do this poor Aaron Hernandez that we're listening to his prison phone calls. But I felt that way, that it was almost too intimate. But it was fascinating to just hear the relationship with him and his fiance. And one of the things I got from it that I think that the documentary shied away from is this guy's kind of a dummy. He's not the sharpest guy. Aaron Hernandez wasn't, and his fiance was. And so it was just odd to listen to their conversations because I felt like she was on a level that he was not on. And you usually don't get that kind of insight into a human relationship, just because how often do you hear people's private most conversations?
Yeah, and, you know, for me, because I think of pretty much everything in terms of economic empowerment, that girl clearly, one, like, super smart, super intelligent, emotionally intelligent, all of that stuff. She made a economic calculation that it was prudent for her to mess with this dude, right?
Like, you think it was economic? You don't think there was an element of, you know, he's got a sweet side and maybe she's attracted to him.
No,
maybe she's attracted to him and he doesn't. Hey, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. You know, you don't think there was an element of that?
No. I mean, obviously he's an attractive cat, but even with something like that, and I think we all make calculations personally that, you know, you don't have to share with the world, but we're all making calculations out there, and like the idea that this woman wouldn't know that he was a closeted homosexual person, that doesn't jive for me. That doesn't jive for me.
She's a little too savvy for that to escape.
100%. And the amount of time she's spending with this guy, the access she has to everything in his life, whether it be his phone and email and blah and this, she's the head of that household. She knows what he's doing. So the idea that she went in there blindfolded, no, like, she made an economic judgment and was like, all right, I love living in a big ass house. I love, you know, the privileges that are afforded to me by being married to a star NFL football player. I'm somebody who thinks she should be empowered to make that decision for herself. I don't harbor any judgments towards her. I just think that was the calculation I was making. And that was, you know, that goes for a lot of the people that were around him. You know what I'm saying? I think they were all making those kinds of calculations, from the goons to, you know, his mom at the one point was like, you could have just gave me $1 million. You signed for 40. And he's like, I signed a deal that got reported for it could potentially be worth for $40 million. I ain't have $40 million in the bank, Mom.
Yeah. Having your salary publicized, I think, has its downsides, and more than just among teammates. I think stuff like that happens. And, you know, a lot of NFL contracts are funny money, and it's not necessarily the big number that's reported. But, yeah, that was brutal. That was just him talking to his mom. Whew, she seems a little cold.
Tough, huh?
Yeah,
tough.
A little cold there. And I think the documentary shied away a little bit from making the obvious point that he was not exactly the sharpest dude in the world. But even that man, who's not the sharpest guy, has all these complexities, even though he's not a genius, and even though he's completely brutal in how he's handling things in his life, there were layers there. And I'm a little bit more of a sap, though, Waz. I think that his fiance loved him. That's my take. I think there was real love there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we love the drunk uncle in our family too, right? Like, I mean, I think to me, like, I'm somebody who thinks a certain amount of proximity breeds a lot of that, right? Mm-hmm. Just by the dint of you're with somebody all the time, and you do get to be there when they're nice all the times they're nice and all of that. Like, I think the proximity and the incentive to see good things in this person is there, right? Like, there's an incentive to see this person as less than a monster.
That's what was voyeuristically fascinating, too, was just to know what this guy was doing and what he did, and then hear these conversations where he's quite sweet. The strangest thing to me was watching the security camera footage of his buddies after they had killed Odin Lloyd playing with his baby, because it was frankly adorable. Like, they had just murdered a man the day before. They had no remorse, but they're all just playing like, oh, look at the baby.
Passing the baby around, playing with him on their lap, like tossing him up and down, like showing a lot, having a lot of fun with him. Of course.
It helps my theory that a lot of the difference between criminals and everybody else is just impulse control. I mean, that's one theory I have, where we're not so different, but they just, maybe the impulse control just isn't there.
Oh my goodness. And this is going to sound controversial, but I've never put my hands on my woman or any woman, and I never will. But do you think?
Jade, you're gonna come on. Jade, you're gonna have to block that one.
I mean, come on.
I mean, it's a real.
Obviously, that's what separates us from criminals. Like, we have an ability to make judgment calls and be like, you know what? I don't have to go with my id. I don't have to go with my human impulses.
Or I could say, you know, we've all been so enraged at somebody, but we have 100%. And I think that's something that Gavin De Becker said in The Gift of Fear, since he's an expert on violence and advises all these Silicon Valley companies on how to prevent violent attacks or look out for threats and celebrities and whatnot. And he wrote that book in the late 90s. And that's something he said, where and he grounds one scene in some murderers, very hard criminals, going to the funeral of a guinea pig, a pet guinea pig of one of the guys at the prison, and a few of them weeping at the funeral. And some of these guys, they do have big hearts. What they don't have is the ability not to see red when the inclination strikes. And that is, I think we like to think of our morality as a little clearer than that, or the difference between them and us is a little clearer. And sometimes it is. Some people are just there's nothing there, and they're complete sociopaths, and there's no ability to interface with human emotion. That exists too, but I think a lot of the people who end up doing awful things just don't have the ability in the moment not to.
Yeah, and another thing that struck me that's related to what you're saying, Ethan, is the NFL's culture of basically creating an incubator that can basically handle these types of people.
Well, that was the other funny thing about the documentary, was at certain times people were saying, you just couldn't imagine it. You know, a football player doing something like this. And I remember I'm pretty sure I could imagine it. I mean, no offense to the football player in public.
I could easily imagine it.
Yeah, it's...
And the infrastructure is built in order to, like, basically, you know, create an ecosystem that these guys can operate in their, you know, sociopathic nature and not sort of fuck up the rest of general society. Because that nature in football society is not a detriment. It's actually an asset.
Yeah, you're supposed to do violence. You need to do violence. Yes. Productive violence. Yes.
And the NFL is basically creating a, you know, they try to make a bubble that is like, all right, we don't want none of this to spill out into polite society because we actually need that shit to function here.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, okay, a few things. I want to take this conversation to a direction before ending it. Well, the first point is I remember in the documentary when Belichick is approached by Aaron Hernandez about wanting to be traded because he thinks he's going to be killed by the enemy he made. That was a scary dude, by the way. The enemy that he made. And I was thinking, this is one of the reasons Belichick isn't a GM technically, but he effectively is. And it's one of the reasons why being a GM just sucks. There's always some bullshit. I mean, you hear about a very tiny little sliver of it in the public, but there's always some bullshit. It's not just here's the team, we're going to win. There's always something crazy like your star tight end approaching you and saying, look, I think somebody's out to kill me. Can you trade me? There's always some crazy thing like that. And then beyond it, I was watching this documentary with my wife. My wife hates football. She doesn't generally like if I meet – I'm meeting up more with college friends recently, and they just love this 49ers season. So that's what they're doing every weekend is watching the 49ers. And I just want to hang out with my college friends. And look, I'm somewhat interested in the Niners season. I'm not a big football fan by any stretch. And so we've just been having discussions about football because she views it in the past. She viewed it as just something she was really bored by. But now she sees it after CTE and everything else as wholly, morally irredeemable.
A moral scourge.
Yeah. And I think she's right. But at the same time, I remember a few weeks ago at my friend's place just watching the Seahawks versus Green Bay in the playoffs in that tundra field. And oh my, football is glorious too. It is glorious. I just remember thinking, you know, I've been living this lie for a few years in order to continue to be accepted as a member of highfalutin society. I have to pretend that soccer is better than this. I just don't think it is. Because that earlier that day, I think either that day or the day before, I had watched Liverpool play against Tottenham. I'd watched that game. So I had that comparison point of a big soccer game versus the NFL playoff game. And I don't know. Just the spectacle, the whole spectacle, the strategy, the tension of it all. I would have to side with NFL as a pure entertainment product while agreeing with my wife that it's completely morally redeemable, while also disagreeing with her and saying maybe we need this as a culture to not go insane. We need this bizarre version of the purge to bring it all back around.
I don't necessarily disagree with any of that, right? I do think there's a moral cost to enjoying football, for sure. And I think we make morality sacrifices in every day, right? Like, we're doing that all the time. And I think, you know, the calculation is a personal one. It's up to you what you want to stomach and what you want to stand
for. And everybody
for.
Knows the risks now, right? It's hard to say going into playing a career of football that you weren't told what could happen.
But what I will say about football that I wish could improve, and I don't think that the quality of the sport and what we're participating in would suffer much if there was an improvement on this. I just wish the culture of football on all levels was a bit less antebellum. It just feels so slavish. It just does. Like, it just, like, there's just a certain, like, overseer mentality to
you don't like the combine pre-draft? You don't like the NFL draft coverage?
That is, oof. That, I mean.
When they start taking out the calipers and, like, measuring the inner thigh of the athlete. You don't like that stuff?
The meat market aspect is whatever. That makes your stomach turn. But there's just something about listening to Dabo Swinney talk about his players that just, I don't know, man. It just makes me, or Jerry Jones when he's talking about, look, when you're a cowboy, we take care of our cowboys. Nobody can tell me that. When he was talking about the collective bargaining agreement, he was like, players don't need XYZ in a contract.
In fairness, he started running the Cowboys during antebellum times. So, you know, right. you can understand it. You can understand it from the Jerry Jones perspective. No, it's everything. It encapsulates a lot of ugly elements of American society. But then it's also just undeniably compelling as a product, and it's just got everything. It's just the most American thing. What are you gonna do? I mean, it took a punch. You know, it looked like football. People were dancing on its grave. It was on the way down. It was on the way out. CTE. Parents aren't gonna have. They're not gonna have little Johnny play football anymore. And America took a collective breath, took a collective pause, and went, you know what? I don't care that much.
Yeah, see, my thing is, I don't think the football will ever die. I think I can see a scenario in the future, in the way distant future, where it becomes more regional than it is right now, right?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I buy that there is a big connection between how many people play a sport and how popular the sport is to watch. Nearly everybody in the country's gone bowling, right? I don't see that translating into huge ratings for the bowling championships, for instance.
Also, I think somebody has to die.
For it to get more popular? No.
No. So it gets
no. I don't even know. I don't know what we're in it for. I don't know. I mean, that's the other question per the Aaron Hernandez documentary. With football, I'm always interested in how much of the violence is part of what people are attracted to versus – you know, a game that has these moments of tension, these pregnant moments, and this fascinating strategy, this chess game. How much of it is the violence is something I've always wondered. How incidental or not incidental?
I think the violence, and I think this is a credit to football, just as and how enjoyable the actual sport is. I think it's not as big as people used to make it out to be because. Watching
You're not supposed to touch the quarterback. The quarterback is the guy who gets to be
sure,
you know.
But not even just the quarterback stuff, the hit stick stuff, like the safety and linebacker over the middle stuff. We see way less of those crazy huge collisions anymore, and nobody's noticed. Nobody cares. Like people still love it. Like you notice when you see one of those. Okay, some guy just got starched. Yeah. Like he literally passed out.
But people love before he even a moment hit the ground. Like when the Niners, Dre Greenlaw, stopped the dude at the goal line with a hit. You know, people love that stuff. Yeah. People are into that stuff. And whatever's happening out there, even if there isn't the big hit, whatever it's doing is causing Luke Kuechly to retire at the age of 28. And I mean, it was fascinating watching his retirement video because he wasn't actually getting into why he was doing it. He was only obliquely referring to it. But it's still – whatever's happening out there, it's still doing that to people. And yeah, it's – you know, football, man, it's undeniable. It's not going away anytime soon. I think it's going to be with us. It's going to be with us a while, annoying my wife. And it is what it is. What are you going to do?
I'll be in attendance at some Super Bowl party next week Sunday. So that's what it is.
As what it is. It is what it is. It is what it is.
Yep. No, Ethan. I went back. They don't say that. They say it's what it is.
It's what it is.
Yeah.
It's what it is.
It's
okay.
It's what it is.
It's what it is. It's what it is. Is that it's from the Miami meeting? Is that the Miami meeting?
Yeah.
It's what it is. That. Yeah, I like the Irishman. I'm not anti the Irish.
It's what it is.
By that I mean Jade Hoy. I like Jade
it's
Hoy.
What it is.
Our resident Irishman. Okay, everybody. That was a wonderful conversation. I want to give a big thanks to Big Waz. I want to give a huge thanks to Jade, who does a fantastic job producing this podcast. I forgot to do a little bit of native marketing of The Victory Machine, my book that you can pre-order today. But yeah, you can do that. And we'll be talking about that more going forward, of course. And hey, stay safe, everybody. Talk to you next time.
That's what it is.
All right, later, y'all.